Hello, everybody. Welcome to our April Vital Health topic. Could everybody just confirm in the chat that you hear me okay so I know? I see that Jill's with us. I see that Jay's with us. Marion's with us. If anybody could give me just the signal in the chat that you can hear me, that would be wonderful. Just so I know I'm not talking to myself. Okay, so we don't have any confirmations. Maybe, Joe can hear me. Yay! Okay, that's all I need. Perfect. Well, thank you, everybody. Welcome again to our vital health topic for April. My name is Angelica. I am on Dr. Reed and Marie's team, and I'm going to be your host today for the call. And I just wanted to welcome you because this is our once-a-month health topic, and we are honored today to have Jenny Nolan. She's one of our certified nutritional endocrinology practitioners. She has an amazing healing story, and she has a thriving practice, and I'm just so excited for her to share today her expertise in thyroid health. I have a feeling that this is going to be a really timely topic for all of us, because we are all really spending more time at home right now. We have to sit with and focus on our habits and what we're doing to bolster our preventative health. So I'm just really, really excited. And I think this is going to be a really juicy topic today about your thyroid. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit about Jenny because she is really impressive and experienced, and she has such a touching healing journey. So I just want to share that with you for a few minutes. So Jenny, again, is a functional nutritionist and certified nutritional endocrinology practitioner. She's based in Eugene, Oregon. She has a nutrition therapy practice since 2015. She serves clients throughout the U.S. and some from around the world. She focuses on nutrition, natural modalities, and lifestyle changes to optimize gut health, thyroid, and metabolic function. Those sound good. She has a lot of certifications. She has a Master of Science degree in clinical nutrition. She received training through the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine. And she's just a very smart lady. Jenny herself has suffered from thyroid cancer and endured a traumatic surgery with rare life-threatening complications 10 years ago. This experience catapulted her to learn more about thyroid function. She embarked on her journey of intense study, which eventually spawned her nutrition practice she has today. Jenny's passionate about educating others, helping them find the root cause of their symptoms, and becoming your own health advocate. You can learn more about Jenny at jennynolan.com. I'll definitely add that link in the chat for you so you can check her out. But for now, I'm going to let Jenny take it away. Go ahead, Jenny.
Wow, what an intro, Angelica. Thank you so much. And I am so excited to be here with you all to talk about thyroid health. I first want to thank Dr. Rita Marie and Angelica for this opportunity for me to present this topic, which is so near and dear to my heart because of my personal experiences. And Angelica just shared quite a bit of it, but in just a few seconds, I will share a lot more details about what happened to me. And this is so related to the topic and the information I'm about to present. I deeply believe this subject is crucially important for everyone, yet largely misunderstood. So today what I'm going to talk about is the thyroid function, including anatomy, types of thyroid disease, symptoms, causes, diagnostic methods, blood test result interpretation, as well as how to use diet, lifestyle, and medication strategies to optimize thyroid function. So due to the time limitation, we only have about 1 hour, so I will just focus on discussing things that are related to hypothyroidism. So when I finish the presentation, I will do a Q&A session to answer questions if you guys have any. So before I dive into the materials, I would like to just give a little more background of my health history And it's pretty intense, but it's just so connected with the information, you know, in this presentation. So I actually have a bachelor's degree in accounting and also an MBA. For the first 15 years of my career, I was on highly stressful jobs working for large corporations as a business and IT professional until I was getting ready to have a second child in my mid-30s. And then I started experiencing miscarriage one after another with total 7 of them, which left me completely puzzled and devastated. Throughout this whole experience, I was so clueless and also wasn't able to find any doctors to help me discover the cause of these, you know, repetitive, painful episodes. And no one, including myself, made a connection between my thyroid issues and these miscarriages. Eventually, my husband and I were fortunate enough to get pregnant again through the IVF procedure. But I had to be at bed rest throughout the whole pregnancy because it was a high-risk pregnancy. 5 months into the pregnancy, I discovered I had thyroid nodules. Immediately, biopsy was done to rule out cancer, and the result came back negative. I was able to carry the pregnancy to full term, but 2 years later, the nodules got larger, and another biopsy was done, again with a negative result. At this point, my voice got hoarse, and the nodules grew even larger, so I decided to get them surgically removed. On October the 1st, 2010, I was finally laying on the operating table ready for the procedure, and that day changed my life forever. So at this point, no doctors had ordered any thyroid-related blood tests, and I had zero knowledge on what the nature of my thyroid issue really was, except for knowing, you know, I had the nodules in my neck. Even to this day, I still don't know if I had hypothyroidism or hyper or Hashimoto's, thyroiditis, or Graves' disease. So the original plan of the surgery was to remove the nodules and maybe part of the thyroid gland. And during the procedure, they did a quick lab testing and discovered 80% of the chance the nodules and the whole thyroid gland, the nodules were cancerous. So they decided to change the original plan and removed both the nodules and the whole thyroid gland. So this change increased the complexity of the procedure, and I ended up having a very rare complication where both my vocal cords were paralyzed, which meant I couldn't breathe on my own. In order to save my life, the ENT surgeon did a tracheotomy procedure to help me breathe. So when I woke up from the procedure, I was faced with two harsh realities. The first one was, okay, I had thyroid cancer, and my thyroid gland was gone when I was unconscious. I wasn't given a chance to vote for either yes or no before this happened. Second, my vocal cords were severely damaged. I couldn't speak, and I had to wear this trach tube inserted into the open wound in my neck. The pain from wearing the tube was so unbearable, and it was by far the most traumatic experience I have ever endured. At the moment, no one could predict whether my vocal cords could recover, how long I would need to wear the trach, or even if I would ever be able to speak again. So long story in short, the wound in the neck eventually healed, and I got my voice back 2 months after the surgery. But the emotional trauma took years to overcome, and the biggest impact that's been ongoing is the lifelong struggle of the complications from living without my own thyroid gland. One year after surgery, I was sent back to the hospital again to receive radioiodine radiation treatment, even though the pathology report showed the cancer was well encapsulated and did not spread, which was very good news. But this also made the radiation treatment unnecessary. Again, this was another mistake because the treatment really was just not supposed to be done. This is a big message I really want to spread out to more people because it's the radiation is so toxic, and do not receive radiation treatment if your thyroid cancer did not spread. So this is obviously a completely messed up situation, and it's painful. But as challenging as it was, there were a lot of wonderful things arose from it. From this challenge, I learned so many lessons. I became to understand what true suffering feels like and what compassion really is. It made me realize I must take my health in my own hands. So I started shifting my life focus and embarked on a new journey, which is to learn health, nutrition, and wellness. And I finally found my new passion. So there you go. That's my whole history. And so today's talk is going to be packed with a lot of information, but please don't worry about understanding and remembering everything. So if you can take one or two things away at the end, it's a big win. This is going to be a gradual and repetitive learning process, so please be patient. And now let's dive in. So first, I would like to read the disclaimer of the presentation. Information provided in this presentation is for informational purposes only. Any information shared here is not intended as a substitute for the medical advice provided by your physician or other healthcare professionals, or any information contained in any product label. So let's take a look at the prevalence of thyroid disease. So these are numbers extracted from American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. There are so many more numbers. I only took just some main ones and put it on the slide. So first, 1 in 10 Americans have thyroid disease. This is actually the number, right? More than the number of Americans with diabetes. And a lot of people don't know. That's how common this is. And since 1980, the fastest increasing cancer for women is actually not breast cancer, but thyroid cancer. And the second statistical number is 50 of those with thyroid disease are unaware of their condition. Even with the treatment, there is a strong chance of being underserved, as many doctors rely on lab results, but not enough on symptoms. So why the conventional medicine has failed in treating thyroid disease? I can see 4 reasons. And number one is there's such a lack of understanding of thyroid function in the medical community. And the second reason, a lot of times, I would say probably 90 to 95% of the times, the conventional doctors would only order incomplete thyroid labs. And also they don't consider the symptoms. So if you combine the incomplete thyroid lab with the fact that the symptoms are not considered, this actually leads to inaccurate diagnosis. So the third reason is medicine prescribed by many doctors doesn't work for most thyroid patients. So we're going to talk about the prescription thyroid medications later on. And also, conventional doctors generally ignore the impact of foods and nutrition. So these are the 4 that makes thyroid treatments very challenging. And so what are the impacts of motor dysfunction? So as you can see on the slide, there are quite a few impacts here, right? So I consider thyroid is the function of youth, because an undiagnosed thyroid disease may put patients at risk for all these other health conditions listed, right, on the slide. It could cause chronic fatigue, glucose metabolism, thyroid cancer, liver and gallbladder dysfunction, and the issue with the protein absorption. It can also impact the brain function and digestive function, and it could contribute to cardiovascular disease as well as osteoporosis. And as we know, thyroid and adrenals, they are so closely connected. So thyroid could cause adrenal fatigue, and vice versa. It could also cause sex hormone imbalances, which could lead to infertility, miscarriage, like what happened to me, preterm delivery, and also developmental problems in children. So so let's take a look at this, you know, the glucose metabolism issue, this connection with the thyroid function. This is very interesting because this is also what I experienced with my own glucose issues. So when there's not enough thyroid hormone being produced, the mitochondria, which is the power of the little batteries in our cells, will reduce their conversion of glucose into energy. So the unused glucose will be stored in our body as fats, causing us to gain weight. That's why the weight gain is one of the main symptoms of hypothyroidism. And then we'll start to feel increasingly tired because the energy supply is just not there. And also our body cutting down on the generation of new cells may cause our nails to grow dry and brittle, our skin to become rough and thin, and our hair to thin and fall out. And the lower the brain activity because of the low thyroid hormone production make us feel confused, forgetful, and depressed. So these are the major thyroid symptoms, and I will cover a little more in details in a few seconds. So now let's take a look at the thyroid anatomy. So take a look at the slide. This is the picture, and it looks pretty straightforward. This pink color, butterfly-shaped gland wrapped around our vocal cord, that's the thyroid gland. And if you see the little brown spots, right, kind of on the thyroid gland, it's actually behind the thyroid gland. Those are the parathyroid glands. And that's why these organs are so closely connected, and that's why any type of thyroid surgery can cause damage to either vocal cords or to parathyroid glands. And I had both of those injuries from this thyroidectomy surgery. The parathyroid glands can be accidentally removed during the surgery when they're trying to remove thyroid nodules. And this could cause a severe impact on the calcium metabolism in the blood and also the parathyroid hormone. So I will cover a little more later on. All right, so let's take a look at how this thyroid hormone production system works. So I consider the thyroid function the thermostat of the human body, because thyroid hormones regulate our metabolism, energy level, the growth and production of every single cell in our body. And so at a high level, when we just take a quick glance, we know thyroid gland takes iodine and tyrosine to produce thyroid hormones. And then a hormone set released into the bloodstream. And then it gets inside of the cells, right, to charge the mitochondria in the cells. And that's how we produce energy. So it takes this hypothalamic, pituitary, and thyroid axis to make all of this happen. So from this little chart on the left, we can see all the organs involved in this thyroid hormone production process. So on the top, it's the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain. And below that, it's the pituitary gland that sits behind our nose. And that's the thyroid gland, right? So hypothalamus is like a CEO in this whole process. It controls many things, right? So it controls, you know, adrenals and a lot of the other systems in the endocrine system. So here, in the thyroid system, hypothalamus sends out the signal to pituitary gland if our body needs more thyroid hormones. So pituitary is like the manager here. And then pituitary glands receive the signal from the hypothalamus. And then it produces a hormone called thyroid stimulating hormone. In short term, it's called the TSH. And we're so familiar with this TSH because this is the marker most of the doctors would order for the patients. So the thyroid gland receives the signal from the pituitary gland, which is the TSH hormone, through the TSH hormone. So TSH is actually not the hormone produced by the thyroid. It's actually the hormone produced by the pituitary. So there's a lot of common misunderstanding on TSH because a lot of people assume it's the thyroid hormone, but it's not. And then thyroid receives the signal, and then it starts to produce thyroid hormones. And then it sends the hormone to the blood, and then it gets inside of the cells and it starts to charge up. So let's take a deeper look at within the thyroid gland, how does it produce hormones? So there are like two main steps involved here. Thyroid actually induces a chemical process that converts tyrosine, which comes from protein-rich food, into something called thyroglobulin, which is another protein molecule designed to bind with iodine. And then in step two, globulin molecule gets combined with 1 to 4 iodine atoms. And the number of atoms attached determines the type of thyroid hormone. And this is why there are 4 types of thyroid hormones produced by the thyroid gland. And they are T1, T2, T3, and TH. So far the scientists are not sure what the T1 and T2 hormones do. But we have a very good understanding on T3 and T4. So T4 is also called tyrosine, which is a storage hormone and comprises 80 to 90% of the thyroid hormone. So this is the majority of the hormone produced in the thyroid gland. It's designed to circulate in the blood and then stored in the tissues until thyroid hormones are needed by a particular area in our body. So when we need thyroid hormones, our body converts T4 into T3. So T3 is the only bioavailable thyroid hormone that our body can use. So here, I think the focus is T3, right? So the conventional doctors, they generally test only TSH and maybe total T4 or free T4. But they generally don't test T3 hormone, which is actually the key because that's the only usable hormone in our body. And we're going to do it differently. So later on, I will talk more about these lab testing and what markers to test and what kind of ranges we want to use. So we know there's a T4 to T3 conversion, which is such an important part of this process, right? So during the T4 to T3 conversion, an enzyme called iodinase type 1 is used to strip off a single iodine atom from the outer lining of T4 molecules, and that's how it becomes T3. So this enzyme actually is stored in the liver, in the kidneys, gut, brain, pituitary gland, muscles, skin, and tissues. So those are the areas where the T4 to T3 conversion happens. And then the reverse T3, right? So reverse T3, you can also see from this chart, there are two pathways in this conversion. If the T4, because we don't need all the T4 to be converted into T3, so for those T4 hormone that doesn't get converted, it's going to go expired, right? So reverse T3 is actually created when a batch of T4 is no longer needed. And after it's outlived, it's just going to be excreted from our body. And this is reverse T3 is another very important blood marker we can monitor to see whether our body converts T4 to T3 well, or if it can be also used for monitoring the thyroid medication to see if we're taking too little or too much. Okay, so this is how this whole system works for producing thyroid hormones. And next, let's take a look at the types of thyroid diseases. There are actually three main categories here. So the first is the hypothyroidism, which is what we're talking about today. The second is hyper. And within hypo and hyper, there are the autoimmune conditions, right? So Hashimoto's thyroiditis is actually related to hypothyroidism, while Graves' disease is actually a type of hyperthyroidism. And then there's the thyroid cancer, which is what I had. And so we're not going to focus too much on talking about the thyroid cancer, because I truly believe if you do have hypo or hyper condition, and if you manage it well, the thyroid cancer can be prevented. So there's another thing called thyrotoxicosis, right? So this is the situation when people notice they actually kind of swing in between hypo and hyper. So meaning like they could be hyper for a few months, and then the next few months they could swing to hyper. And then this kind of can go on, this situation can go on for a while, and then at the end, generally, most people settle down in hypo. And as we can see on the numbers, hypothyroidism actually is the most common thyroid disease. So it's about 80% of the whole thyroid cases. And then within the hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's thyroiditis is actually 70 to 80% of the whole hypothyroid cases. So this means actually most people who have hypothyroidism are actually autoimmune, right? So because we know Hashimoto's is an autoimmune condition. And within the hypothyroidism category, there is another condition, which is actually not the problem in the thyroid gland. It's actually called a peripheral tissue resistance to thyroid hormones caused by insulin resistance and adrenal dysfunction due to the high cortisol production. So I will explain in more details about these about the differences between these conditions. Okay, so this is a lot of symptoms we can see on the slide. On the left, those are symptoms from hypothyroidism, and on the right, these are the symptoms from hyper. There are some common symptoms shared by both conditions listed on the top in the red color, and also at the bottom in the green color. Oh, actually, the red color means they're the opposite symptoms, right? For example, the hypo has the weight gain symptoms, while hyper has the losing weight for no apparent reason sort of symptom. And then at the bottom, it's like the green color. Those are the symptoms, the common symptoms shared by both conditions. So in the middle, that's the unique symptoms from each condition. So if you have 3 to 4 symptoms in each category, you can definitely pay more attention to do some investigation on the thyroid function. You don't need to have all the symptoms to develop hypothyroid or hyperthyroid. So this is definitely very, just because this is such a wide range of different symptoms, right? So you don't need to have all of them. But just take a look, the most common ones of the hypothyroidism symptoms include fatigue, stubborn weight gain, no matter how hard you try to lose, constipation, low libido, feeling cold, cold hands and cold feet, some brain fog, you know, the nails, right, and the loss of the third eyebrows, those are very common, sometimes ringing in the ears, that kind of stuff. And a miscarriage. If you have repetitive miscarriage happening, you definitely want to check your thyroid. Okay, so what are the diagnostic tools to help us investigate on if our thyroid function is normal? So the first one is the physical exam. This is so easy. We can do it at home in front of the mirror. So all what you need to do is to swallow some water, and then you look at yourself in the mirror in the neck area. When you're swallowing, if you notice some protrusional movement in the neck, right, and it's kind of uneven on both sides, that's a sign there might be a nodule or nodules growing in the thyroid gland. And you can do this anytime you want, right? So this is a very effective way to do some early detection. The body temperature measurement, that's the second one. So what you can do is to buy the mercury-free thermometer where you put it in the mouth and then you measure the body temperature first thing when you wake up. And then you monitor again 3 hours later, and then another time 3 hours after the second measurement. So you do it like 3 times each day, and then you calculate the average body temperature for that day. So you do this for like 3 days in a row, and that's how you can have a pretty good picture on your average body temperature. And if your average body temperature is below 98.6, that's a sign there could be a thyroid issue, right? And it doesn't have to be the exact number, but at least you want your body temperature to be above, to be at least 98. And then the third method is the blood test. So we're going to take a look later on at all the markers and the optimal ranges. So for blood tests, I would recommend anyone, no matter whether you have thyroid issue or not, test your thyroid panel once a year at least. And they should be part of the annual physical. So you definitely want your doctor to order the thyroid panel for you when you go in for an annual physical checkup. And if you change your thyroid medication, you want to test the whole thyroid panel about 6 to 8 weeks after the change of the medication. And there's the neck ultrasound that can be done. And so It should be done at the time of the diagnosis of any type of thyroid disease. Immediately, right? Whether you notice that you have nodules or not. So if the blood test shows you have some kind of hypo or hyperthyroidism, you want to have an ultrasound right away. And also, 6 months, if you notice you have nodules and the nodule is growing. So you want to monitor the nodules every 6 months through the neck ultrasound. And if you don't have nodules, you want to do it once a year. The fine needle aspiration, that's what I had. So it's where they insert the needle in your neck, right? So you don't want to do this unless you know you do have, you know, nodules in the neck. And this test is really more used for detecting whether the nodules are cancerous or not. But it's not always accurate. Remember, my story was I had 2 fine needle aspirations. Both came back negative, but I still ended up having cancer, right? Because the needle could only touch the tissue in one area. It doesn't cover the whole nodules. And you might have cancer cells in other parts of the nodules and the needle didn't get in touch with, right? So again, just keep in mind that the result is not always accurate. Excisional biopsy. That's when they go in to cut a piece of the thyroid gland and send it to the lab. So that's a little bit more intrusive. The iodine uptake and thyroid scan. This can also be done, but there's radiation involved. I don't quite recommend it. Okay, so there is the blood test now. Let's take a look and see what can we test in the blood. This is such an important piece of information here. So again, the conventional doctors generally order TSH, which is the hormone produced by the pituitary gland. They sometimes would order free T4 or total T4. But what we really care about is free T3. This is the only bioavailable thyroid hormone. So the TSH, generally, okay, it's different for everyone. Generally, the ideal range is from 0.9 to 2. For most people, they feel the best when TSH is within this range. And let's take a look at the free T3, because that's so important. The free T3, for most people, you want it to be at least 3. And if it's below 3, that's when a lot of people start to experience hypothyroid symptoms that comes with fatigue and tiredness and all of that, right? And slowed metabolism. So if it's above 4.5, it could be too much. So if you're on a thyroid medication, you want to make sure free T3 is not elevated too high because that can actually turn into a hyper situation. So for free T4 marker, we want the range to be in between 1.1 to 1.8. Reverse T3, right? So reverse T3, again, this is that mechanism when our body excretes the expired T4. So if reverse T3 is too high, that tells us something, right? It tells us your body is not converting T4 into T3 very well. And if you are on any type of thyroid hormone therapy, if the reverse T3 is high, and that has a lot to do with what type of thyroid medication you're taking, right? So whether, and I'm going to talk about the medications a little bit more. So if the reverse T3 is high when you're on the thyroid medication, it could mean that you're taking too much, the dosage is too high, or if you're taking T4-based thyroid medication, again, your body probably doesn't convert it into T3 very well. So it ends up being reverse T3. And also, there are 2 antibody markers we want to test to see whether your hypothyroidism is actually Hashimoto's thyroiditis or it's just the regular hypothyroidism. So the two antibody markers are thyroglobulin antibody and thyroid peroxidase antibody. So basically, we want these two antibodies to be close to be zero. So that's the lower the better, right? And before, the ranges of these two are quite higher than what we see on the screen. It's like for TPO, it's 35 or something, but now they lowered it to either one or two. These are the two key markers to detect whether you have autoimmune version of hypothyroidism. And lastly, the free T3 over reverse T3 ratio. Not a lot of people actually do this calculation, but if your doctor orders all of these markers, you can actually do a calc at home, right? So if it's 20% above, that's a good thing. That means you are actually having, they're in ratio, right? You're having enough free T3 to support your body function. If it's only 10%, that just means most likely you're not having enough free T3. And also, let's just say if you have had some kind of thyroid surgery before, you definitely want the doctor to monitor your parathyroid hormone, which is in short term, which is PTH. You also want to test the phosphatase and calcium level because during the surgery, again, the parathyroid gland can be accidentally removed. And that could cause hypoparathyroidism, which can elevate phosphatase level in the blood, and then it can lower the calcium level. So just remember, phosphatase and calcium, they're actually in ratio. They have this inverse relationship with each other. And if your calcium level goes too low, it can really make you feel really, really weird. And so definitely make sure to monitor if you had a surgery before. Okay, so there are a few more markers, blood markers that can be monitored. So the first one is vitamin D, right? We want to make sure it's in between 60 to 80. And the rest of the markers are related to the tissue level hypothyroidism. And I mentioned it briefly in the earlier slide. So let's just say is it possible for a person to still experience hypothyroid if all the thyroid markers on the last slide tested normal? If they're all normal, you know, for example, TSH, T4, T3, if all of these things are normal, is it possible you can still experience hypothyroid symptoms? And the answer is yes. This is actually getting a little more complicated, so I'm just going to briefly touch on the subject a little bit. So the next marker is thyroid binding globulin. This marker is actually commonly used for monitoring the tumors, right, in the thyroid, especially after you had a thyroidectomy, to make sure, because they want to make sure they remove most of the thyroid gland. If you didn't have a surgery, you can still use this marker to evaluate your thyroid function, because thyroid binding globulin is actually a protein carrier that the thyroid hormone is bound to, as the thyroid hormones are being transported through the body. So when the thyroid hormone is bound to this thyroid binding globulin, it's inactive. It cannot be used by the body. So it has to be cleaved from the thyroid binding globulin to become free fraction before it can activate the cellular receptors. So if you have too much thyroid binding globulin, that could actually mean you have way too much T3 to be that are bound with this protein molecule, and you end up having very little bioavailable T3 for the body to use, which could lead to hypothyroidism. So you want to make sure this marker is not too high. And the second thing that can be tested is estrogen dominance, right? So because there's such a relationship between estrogen dominance and hypothyroidism, the reason is the estrogen really impacts the thyroid health, because estrogen can increase T4, estrogen can actually increase thyroxine binding globulin, which is, I'm just going to use the short term, which is the TBG, which is the thyroid binding globulin. So it can increase this TBG production in the liver. It also impacts the conversion of T4 to T3, which could lead to low T3 level, right? So too much estrogen can also block the uptake of thyroid hormones into the cells, and once again leading to symptoms of hypothyroidism. So this actually means, even though there is not a direct issue with the thyroid gland, the symptoms of hypothyroidism can still be experienced, right? And this is called the peripheral hypothyroidism. So these symptoms often manifest most strongly during the menopause, when the progesterone levels are significantly decreased, but estrogen is still present, which is part of the estrogen dominance scenario. So how do we identify estrogen dominance? If estrogen levels are satisfactory, we can then take a look at something called sex hormone binding globulin for evaluation on peripheral tissue resistance to thyroid hormone. And so what's the, intricate connection here? So the role of sex hormone binding globulin is to regulate and transport sex hormones such as estrogen and testosterone. It's mainly produced in the liver. And so it actually binds to the sex hormones and shuttles them to the tissues. It's kind of like the same mechanism between thyroid binding globulin and thyroid hormones, right? They're binding proteins. So when the sex hormones are bound to sex hormone binding globulin, their hormones are not free and cannot be used. So if your sex hormone binding globulin is low, right, so you have very little binding protein bound to estrogen or testosterone, so the result of that would be high estrogen. And high estrogen could lead to hypothyroidism. So it's kind of like estrogen and thyroid hormones, they compete with each other. And they also have this inverse relationship. That's why we don't want to have too much estrogen in our body, because it could contribute to hypothyroidism. And vice versa, if your sex hormone binding globulin is too high, it could lead to low level of estrogen production, right? And if you have very little estrogen, it could contribute to hyperthyroidism. So generally, this sex hormone binding globulin is a better marker for women than men. And also, it's more accurate when a person is not on any type of sex hormone replacement therapy. And so what are the ranges we are looking at? So for women, we want this marker to be in between 70 to 144. For men, it's a lot lower. So hopefully this is not too overwhelming. There's a lot of intricate information here. So let's take a look at the causes of hypothyroidism, right? So the first one is radiation exposure, x-rays, imaging exams, and electronic devices. medications, birth control pills, blood pressure medications, diabetic medications, anti-seizure medications, and also antidepressants, you know. So those are not so good for our thyroid function. And if your pituitary gland dysfunctions, generally it's manifested in the blood test as low TSH, low T3, and low T4. So if you see this pattern in the blood test, you definitely want to do investigation on the pituitary function. More causes, right? So adrenal dysfunction, which is related to chronic stress, and so elevated cortisol can contribute to poor T3 to T4 conversion, which causes more reverse T3. So if our reverse T3 is too high, it really can block the receptors on the cells. So the free T3 really will be challenged to penetrate the cells. That's the reason why we don't want to have high reverse T3. So for the tissue level hypo, which is a conversion issue, right? So there could be a liver issue because 20 to 30% of the conversion from T4 to T3 happens in the liver. There could be also gut issue because around 20% of the conversion happens in the gut. So these two main areas are really what we want to look into whenever we experience some kind of hypothyroid symptoms. The insulin resistance is another cause because the insulin released by the pancreas, right? And we know it has a role in the glucose metabolism, but it also plays a role in the T3 penetrating the cells because too much insulin can cause the blockages for this penetration process. So we don't want to have a lot of insulin in the body. And also nutrition is another huge factor here, right? So what we eat has so much to do with pretty much all the systems in the body, and thyroid is just one of them. Food sensitivities, and so the six foods listed in the red color are the most common food allergens a lot of people actually react to. So I would eliminate all of them if you have either hypothyroidism or Hashimoto's, because it can actually cause the immune system to react and to produce the antibodies, right? That's part of the reason the thyroid antibody markers are elevated. And I have seen from different clients, their antibodies literally come down when they removed these foods. So it's sometimes it can be that simple, but most of the times it's not. It's more complicated. Nutritional deficiencies, right? So iodine, protein, vitamin D, magnesium, selenium and zinc deficiency, ferritin and B12. These are all the nutrients needed to support our thyroid function. Toxins, again, play another huge role in here. So the chemical toxins, halogens, heavy metals, and mycotoxins coming from mold, all of these things could play a huge role in our thyroid function. The causes of Hashimoto's. So we know there's a difference between Hashimoto's thyroiditis and the average hypothyroidism. Hashimoto's is the autoimmune condition, and generally it takes three factors to develop any types of autoimmune disease. The first one is the genetic predisposition for autoimmune disease. Second is the leaky gut, and the last is the environmental triggers listed on the last slide. So how to manage hypothyroid? Stress management, right? So chronic stress, right? It can trigger our cortisol to be released. And also the prolonged cortisol elevation decreases the liver's ability to clear excess estrogen. And we know moments ago that we don't want to have too much estrogen in the blood. And then, so the conclusion of this is cortisol inhibits the conversion of T4 to T3, but increases the conversion of T4 to reverse T3. And so that's the stress management part, which is the reason behind the saying why managing stress is so important. Removal of the potential toxic exposure, that can greatly help as well. Iodine is actually definitely needed for producing thyroid hormone, but we don't want too much of it, right? So the daily need for iodine is generally 150 to 300 micrograms. Too much of it can exacerbate the hypothyroid symptoms. And this can be different from person to person. Infrared sauna is also a great tool for removing toxic load. And also we can use adaptogen herbs, minerals, and vitamins to boost our thyroid function. So we, for example, vitamin D, vitamin B, and vitamin A, right? Vitamin A helps our T3 hormone to get into the cells. Trace minerals such as iodine, selenium, and zinc, magnesium, fish oil, which is EPA, DHA coming from omega-3 fish oil, that's also really, really helpful for reducing the inflammation in the body. The commonly used herbs for boosting thyroid function include ashwagandha, licorice root, Siberian ginseng, wild oats, nettles, schisandra, and triphala. You don't have to use all of these things, but I would say definitely the basic ones I would use is the trace mineral complex, enough vitamin D supplement, and maybe B as well. It depends on the person, how vitamin B works. Vitamin A, magnesium, and also EPA and DHA. The herbs, you can kind of experiment a little bit. The most commonly used one is ashwagandha. Okay, so what are the dietary recommendations? I would not do the calorie-restricted diet. It is not, it just doesn't work for people who suffer from hypothyroidism. And I would recommend remove the 6 most reactive foods, gluten, dairy, peanuts, eggs, corn, soy, and sugar. And I highly recommend anti-inflammatory diet. The bitters, that's also great for boosting digestion. And also tyrosine, right? So we know iodine and tyrosine are 2 main ingredients for our thyroid gland to produce hormones. So where do we get the tyrosine from? We get it from protein in the food. So I like to actually recommend people eat a protein-rich breakfast because in the morning, we really need to charge up our body so that, you know, we can have enough energy to get through the day. So if you eat protein for breakfast, that's a wonderful tip to boost your thyroid function. Iodine. The proper amount of iodine, so you can get it from sea vegetables and the Himalayan pink salt. And also, here comes the gut health, right? So we just reviewed the gut system converts about 20% of the T4 into T3. So a lot of people, I noticed in my client group, a lot of people actually have some kind of gut infections if they have Hashimoto's. So the gut infections that are so common for people in this group are Epstein-Barr virus, parasites, especially blastocystis hominis. It has a close connection with hypothyroidism, H. pylori bacterial infection, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and candida yeast overgrowth. So this is so complicated, the gut health, right? So I'm only listing some of the gut infections here. And as far as for how to eradicate them, that's going to be another presentation. And let's take a look at the thyroid prescription, the medications here. So what are the options? I would say do not take the OTC thyroid glandular remedies because the potency of the thyroid hormones contained in these remedies are not consistent between the batches. So when it comes to the management for thyroid disease, we want to be very consistent, especially when it comes to prescription drugs. Low-dose naltrexone is commonly used for Hashimoto's. It's an immune modulator. It can reduce antibodies, but it doesn't work for everyone. So it's kind of like something people can experiment with. There are two types of thyroid hormone prescriptions. One is the synthetic hormone prescription, and the other is a natural desiccated thyroid prescription medication. So within the synthetic group, we have T4, T3, and a combination of both. So Synthroid is actually the most commonly prescribed. It's actually a T4 drug, right? So once you take it, your body still has to convert it into T3 for Synthroid to work in your body. Most people have struggled converting it. That's why the synthetic T4 medication rarely works for most people. And T3 medication, which is Cytomel, leothyronine, those two are commonly prescribed. So if you combine the synthetic T4 and T3, you could have a better result. So I personally take the combination of synthetic T4 and T3 at this point. I have tried pretty much everything you can see on the screen. I'm currently on the combination of synthetic. So why not the natural desiccated, right, such as Armour, NatureThyroid, WP Thyroid, or MP Thyroid? It's just pros and cons. The advantages the synthetic prescription have are, first of all, it's very consistent. The dosages generally don't vary from batch to batch. So that's the biggest benefit. The downside of it is that it does not have the other attributes that the natural desiccated thyroid prescription have. For example, Armour, MP, and NatureThyroid, they're actually made from the porcine thyroid glands, right? So they naturally contain T1 and T2 thyroid hormones, as well as some other natural components. So that's why a lot of people find it just works so much better than the synthetic. There are some truths to it. So again, this is very individual, and it works differently for everybody. So you can actually, if you have a doctor who's willing to prescribe all of them, you can definitely experiment. And I would recommend people who still have the thyroid gland try the natural desiccated prescription. For people who no longer have the thyroid gland anymore, it's probably better to take the synthetic because of the consistency of their dosages. So circling back to my story, what could have been done differently if I had the knowledge back then? I would definitely manage the stress better. And secondly, I would optimize my nutritional status. And back then, I wasn't doing nutrition as my career, so I was just clueless, right? And then get informed when discovering thyroid nodules. Anytime when we discover, oh, there's something going on in my body, we absolutely want to learn more about it, right? And that's what prepares us to have a very intelligent conversation with our doctors. we don't want to totally depend on the doctors. And that's the biggest lesson I learned. Don't do anything or everything or just depend on them, because a lot of times you will find they don't have all the information for you. They also don't know your body as well as you do. The next lesson I learned was the early stage regular thyroid exam and the blood panel should have been done. And this, if I had done those things, this could have prevented the miscarriages I had and also the thyroid cancer. And also, I truly believe the complete thyroidectomy was a mistake. It should have been avoided. Because a lot of people nowadays, they have nodules, but you don't want to get the whole thyroid gland removed, right? You remove the nodules and maybe part of the gland. You definitely want to do as much as possible to keep at least part of your thyroid gland in your body. It is such important. It's such an important lesson I learned. And you want to discuss the potential complications from the surgery with your doctor if you do need a surgery. And again, the radiation treatment should have been avoided. If your cancer did not spread into other parts of your body, when it comes to thyroid cancer, it's a little different than other types of cancers. It's less threatening, less dangerous, and generally it doesn't spread easily. So if your pathology report shows, you know, your cancer did not spread and your doctor says, oh, you want to have a radiation treatment, my recommendation is don't do it. But again, this is, you know, each person's decision, but this is just kind of what I learned from my own story. So where should I start? What should I do to start from here, right? I truly believe the future of the medicine is the patient. Managing your stress level is number one. Balancing your nutritional status. Do annual thyroid screening by doing the at-home self-physical exam, by, you know, taking the complete thyroid blood panel, either ordered by your doctor or some other practitioners, and do the annual thyroid ultrasound. Also, get help from an expert if your doctor is not helpful. And I think that concludes my presentation today. Angelica, can you hear me? Hello?
Hello.
Hello.
Awesome.
Any questions, guys?
Good job of explaining everything. You were so articulate and so detailed and so very touched by your personal story. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Oh, is this Rita Marie? Oh my gosh.
Hi. Oh my gosh. I'm a little late because I had another call, but I snuck in to listen and you did an awesome job. So thank you so much. I'm sure everybody learned a lot.
I hope it's not too much. It's just so much information.
Well, it is a lot of information, and you know, they can take or leave, right? But we have a lot of geeky people in our community who like that level of knowledge. So if anybody has questions for Jenny, I see Angelica just came back. If anybody has questions for Jenny, I'll let Angelica kind of coordinate and get those questions out of the chat and the Q&A, or come on the line and just do a star two and open up your line. I know there was a lot there, but it was awesome information. So thank you so much.
All right. I've checked the Q&A box and the chat. So one question we had from Martha is, can you take ashwagandha every day?
Yes. So ashwagandha, it has so many benefits, right? So people also take it at bedtime. It can help the sleep. It improves the sleep quality. And it's an adaptogen herb. So I believe that it could potentially reduce the antibody levels, but some people believe it's a nightshade, right? So we believe that for autoimmune disease, the nightshade stuff is probably, you know, that probably shouldn't have been taken. But I think it really depends on the person. Some people, most people can do it just fine. You know, maybe a small percentage of the people might experience some issue with the nightshade, especially the nightshade vegetables, nightshade herbs, and that kind of thing. Yeah, you can definitely take it every day if it works for you.
If it works for you. I'm going to chime in and say, yes, I agree with that, because you have to go person by person. And there's just a lot of general information out there. Don't eat this. Do eat this. This is great. This is bad. And if we listened to all of that, we'd go nuts because we wouldn't be able to eat anything, right? So I think it's people with severe inflammatory conditions, usually, you know, people with a lot of joint arthritic joint pain will notice that they flare up with nightshades. A lot of the things with nightshades, it's not like an allergy response where even that little teeny tiny morsel is going to trigger it. With nightshade sensitivity, oftentimes it's a quantity. So somebody may be able to eat one tomato, but not two. And given ashwagandha is taken in such teeny tiny amounts compared to peppers, tomatoes, eggplant, and those sorts of things, I think it's certainly worth a try, because for a couple of reasons, if it's hypothyroid, not hyper, which you probably mentioned earlier, because it actually does help the thyroid to produce better. So it does a really good job of that. It's known, it's been studied for eons in traditional kind of literature. And again, with everything, here's my take, and you might probably agree with this, Jenny, is that whenever you're starting a new supplement or herb, go slow, low and slow, tiny dose, little bit, tiny dose, little bit. If you notice you get better with it, great. If you notice that you get worse with it, then don't do it. And if you notice nothing, then you can gradually increase the doses till you get to the full dose. So I think ashwagandha is an amazing herb, and it has been studied to be very helpful with autoimmune. I've had some other things like CoQ10 and what else? what's the other one I'm thinking of? Anyway, there's another herb that's really super good for it as well. So anyway, thank you for sharing that perspective, because I want everybody to keep coming back to the individual act. Jenny was treated like a textbook. She didn't have the textbook symptoms. She didn't have the textbook response, and nobody dug deeper, right? And that's what caused her to have so much trouble. We don't want that for anybody else.
That's right. Yeah, myself was definitely not my own advocate at the time.
Right.
Just no knowledge, just totally trusted the doctors and did exactly what they said. And that's why I suffered.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting another question about ashwagandha. Barbara asks, how much ashwagandha should we take? I think I know the answer coming up.
I actually don't have a particular dosage to recommend, but I would actually find something with maybe just 500 milligrams a day. There are some products with higher dosages, but I would just start, just like what Dr. Rita Marie said, just start something low. Find something that has the lowest dosage and see how that works for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I can slowly increase, yeah.
Right, you can't just take a textbook off the shelf. Somebody weighs 75 pounds versus somebody weighs 225 pounds.
Right.
There's no standardized dose, right?
Mm-hmm.
But with ashwagandha, there's so many ways you could get it. You could get capsules. You could get a tincture. You could get a powder. You can get an extract powder, or you can get just a pure powder. And it depends on what you get, what the dose is for you. Personally, when I do the powders, somewhere between a half to a teaspoon is a fuller dose. But again, you know, if you get a tincture, it may say that the full dose is 40 drops. Don't just pull it out and start taking 40 drops. Start with one or two and then increase it gradually.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's the good thing about having the tincture. Because
yeah. That's what I love about the tincture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. Good suggestions. Paula would like to know if fasting is contraindicated for hypothyroidism.
Say it again, fasting?
Yeah, is fasting not advised for hypothyroidism?
That's an interesting question. I'm personally not against intermittent fasting at all. I think, you know, it can be absolutely implemented with hypo, but you probably want to arrange your meal times in a reasonable way where it doesn't impact your energy production. Because the less you eat, sometimes, you know, if you eat too little, you probably don't get enough energy from the foods, right? So that's a very interesting question, actually, between the fasting and the thyroid function. I would also consider the other situations your body is dealing with before, you know, making a decision on this, right? So, for example, your blood sugar situation and your goal in general. So without knowing those other factors, it's a little hard to recommend anything.
Yeah, I think that you're right in answering that way. And what I find is that it depends on the person and it depends on how their body's responding. So we know that fasting for any length of time could cause a decrease in the T3 and an increase in reverse T3 just because the body is going into preserve mode. It's going into that, oh, let's slow this down. So reverse T3 is the brakes and free T3 is the accelerator. So it's like, oh, we don't have a lot of reserves, slow it down. That could be a good thing. But if you're trying to go ahead with just running a daily life, it could impact your energy. So I would tune into that. It can decrease the TSH production as well. But that's usually with more extended fasting, like 3 days or more. That said, it could be a very helpful thing for getting people out of this situation. But if it's somebody, that's if you're going away to a fasting retreat, right? If you're going to do a 10-day fast and you're going to be supervised and your vitals are going to be taken, because there's a lot of things that affect, you know, get affected by the thyroid gland, then it could be very good. But on your own, I would probably, you know, at most do maybe 36-hour fast, you know, so do like a 16-hour fast, you know, just really shorten your window. See how you feel. Some people feel like, oh my God, I feel so much better now, because you're helping the digestion get better, because the digestion doesn't have to work. And all that reserve energy that was going towards digestion can go towards energy production. So, you know, it's a very individualized situation. Fasting always is. And I always tell people whenever they're doing fasting is the same thing as I tell them with supplementation. Start low and slow. Start with just extending your feeding, your sleep window, your fasting window over sleep, and then little by little you can do it. And I've had people who've done phenomenally well by doing it that way, and then doing a 1-day fast, and then eating, and then doing a 2-day fast, and eventually got to an extended fast. But everybody's a little bit different, and I would just proceed with caution.
Makes sense.
Okay. Well, I'd like to invite people. We did have another follow-up question from Barbara about other adaptogens. She just asked, I think, about dosages for the other adaptogens you mentioned in your presentation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'll probably be an iteration of the ashwagandha advice, but what would you advise about dosing all adaptogens you mentioned?
Yeah, so first of all, I wouldn't take all of them at one time. There were just so many of them, it's impossible to take all of them at one time, and it also doesn't make sense. So I would try maybe just one at a time, one or two at a time with a very low dose, and see how you feel. And then maybe if you like it, you can increase the dose, just like what Dr. Rita Marie said. And you can experiment a little. You know, I like to experiment different supplements or herbs, you know, just to see how I feel with them. So that's what I would like to recommend. If you just have a little bit signs of hypothyroidism, there are supplements that have a combination of these herbs, and they're designed for boosting thyroid health. So that can be experimented with. So I sometimes do take some of those, and if you need any recommendations on certain products, I can provide the name.
Yeah, there's a lot of them out there.
A lot of them, yes.
Mm-hmm. People who tend to be super sensitive to supplements, like, oh, I have to just start slow. It's really challenging to get a combination formula, because if you react to it, then you don't know why you reacted to it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's, I always like, this is my way, you know, everybody can do it differently, but I always like to start with singles and play around with them, and then do combinations of singles. And then if you find a combination that really is really super good, then you might want to find a formula that puts it together, or experiment and venture out into the formula world. But it's, everything's a little, it's individual, and some adaptogen, like some people don't react the same as others. So some adaptogens will tend to be a little more calming, but some of them are true adaptogens where if you need to sleep, they're going to put you to sleep. And if you need energy, they're going to give you energy. Mm-hmm. And, like Shizandra tends to be one of those more soothing, calming adaptogens that I would take at bedtime, especially if you have trouble sleeping. And, you know, a thyroid can't repair overnight, and you won't have energy the next day. And ashwagandha does tend to go both ways. I've had people take it in the morning with great success. I've had people take it at bedtime with great success.
Yes, yeah. There is a product from Restorative Formulations called ThyroCare. So it's a combination of iodine, selenium, kelp, some myrrh, you know, which is the bitter herb, and also nettle, ashwagandha, and triphala, and also ginger roots.
Mm-hmm.
I really like this formula. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I've had good results with that formula as well.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. That's good to know.
I really like that formula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just the right amount of, they have another one that has more iodine, so I'm cautious with that unless I know the person needs more iodine.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest misconceptions about iodine is, you know, a lot of people think, oh, they have Hashimoto's, so they can't take any iodine.
No.
Right. But I think everybody needs some.
Absolutely. You can't make thyroid hormone without iodine. It's the core. Tyrosine and iodine are the core. So it's really, I think, irresponsible to tell people don't have any iodine. Our soils are depleted. And if you're not eating foods like kelp, different kinds of seaweeds that have a lot of iodine in it, then you're not getting it from your diet because the soils are depleted. And it's a hard mineral to absorb. It requires really strong stomach acid to get the iodine to be able to absorb. And many people, especially by the time they hit 40 or 50, have diminished stomach acid. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's very individualized. If you guys, we have a program called Thyroid Revive and Thrive. And we take you through, you know, a lot of stuff similar to what Jenny presented, and take you through like a step by step. There's almost, if you have this, then this. If your labs say this, then it could be that. And we go through a lot of depth on that and the receptor resistance, which is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Excellent. We have a few questions from one of our callers, Soraya. I hope I'm saying your name correctly. If you'd like to come on, Soraya, if anybody would like to raise their hand to ask a question and speak to Jenny and Dr. Reed Marie live, you can press star 2 on your phone. And so Soraya had a few questions, so I'll just kind of list them off. But Soraya, if you'd like to raise your hand, go ahead and we will open up your microphone. In the meantime, I'll go over your questions you sent in. So Soraya asked, could you please expand more on estrogen dominance and thyroid imbalance?
Yes, well, that's the complicated one, right? I can explain a little more. So the estrogen and thyroid hormone, the estrogen hormone and thyroid hormone, they kind of compete against each other, which means if you have way too much estrogen, you might end up having too little thyroid hormone. And the biggest problem nowadays is so many women have estrogen dominance, right? So it's either caused by perimenopause or menopause, or, you know, the chemical toxins, which is the xenoestrogens coming from personal care products. So those are all the potential causes of estrogen dominance. And the reason why too much estrogen actually can lower the thyroid hormone is because estrogen, first of all, estrogen lowers this, it actually increases the production of thyroid binding globulin, which is that marker. This marker over here, right? Thyroid binding globulin. So if you have too much estrogen, it can increase the production of this protein carrier in the liver. And then once you have too much protein carrier, which is the thyroid binding globulin, you will have too much thyroid hormones that are bound to this protein carrier. And once the thyroid hormones are bound with this protein carrier, they're inactive. They cannot be used by your body. So you will end up having less free T3, which is the only bioavailable thyroid hormone for your body to use. So that's that's one thing. And also estrogen can affect the conversion of T4 to T3, which again leads to low T3 level. And also, you know, the estrogen can also block the uptake of the thyroid hormones into the cells. So we need the thyroid hormones to penetrate the cells, right? So that our cells can be charged up. That's how we produce energy. But estrogen can block the uptake, which is it could block the receptors on the cells, where it makes it challenging for the thyroid hormones to get inside of the cells. And this can all cause the symptoms of hypothyroidism. So this is kind of the peripheral hypothyroidism I was talking about. So a lot of people, they might have a perfectly functioning thyroid gland where their TSH, T4, T3, all these markers are normal and the antibody levels are all normal, but they could still have hypothyroid symptoms. And the causes are many other things, right? Estrogen is one of them. Insulin resistance, right, which is related to the glucose metabolism issue. That's another reason, and another reason, and also just too much cortisol coming from adrenals due to the stress. So those things can all cause the peripheral level of the hypothyroidism. As far as for the sex hormone binding globulin, it's just kind of like a deeper look at why estrogen has a relationship with the thyroid function, right? So because the sex hormone binding globulin works just like thyroid binding globulin, it's a protein carrier. So instead of binding with the thyroid hormone, sex hormone binding globulin actually binds with estrogen and testosterone, which is the sex hormones. So if your sex hormone binding globulin is too low, what happens is you will end up having way too much estrogen in your body, right? Because there's not enough protein carrier bound to the estrogen. So, and then the high estrogen could contribute to hypothyroidism. And that's why sex hormone binding globulin can also be a very useful tool to evaluate peripheral, you know, the peripheral tissue resistance to to thyroid hormones. Does this make sense?
It definitely makes sense. It's to me, the takeaway is just too much sex hormone, too much estrogen equals less thyroid hormone function.
Right, right, exactly, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so if it's hard to understand all the details, you can just know on the high level, okay, too much estrogen leads to, you know, could. I'm not saying it's for everybody, right? But it could. Too much estrogen could reduce your thyroid hormone.
Thank you. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important takeaway.
Right, right. Yeah.
Another question from Soraya, and it's a kind of another big picture question. What's the connection between thyroid imbalance and brain function, like lack of concentration or focus?
Oh, yes, because the brain cells are just like any other cells in the rest of the body, right? It also needs the thyroid hormones to charge them up, you know, in the brain. So if your thyroid hormones are just not there, your whole metabolism slows down. So not only you're tired, but your brain also slows down too, right? So it's just, you know, that feeling where if you didn't sleep well the night before, everything just runs slow the second day. You don't think clearly and you don't feel energetic. So it's all caused by, you know, not enough thyroid hormone to charge the brain cells and also other cells in the rest of the body. So that's why a lot of times people who have hypothyroidism have brain fog and headaches. That's a very common symptom. I used to have them all the time. So that's kind of the connection right there based on what I know. Dr. Rita Marie? Hello?
I think Dr. Rita Marie popped in first.
Sorry, I had to answer an email. What was the question? And I will chime in and answer.
This is a connection between hypothyroidism and the brain fog and the headaches, the brain function. It's just not, your brain cells are not charged enough.
Yeah, you're not getting enough energy to it.
Right.
You don't get ATP to your brain cells. You don't get glucose uptake as well. So there's this very intimate connection between thyroid function and blood sugar balance.
Mm-hmm.
And when your thyroid's out of balance, it's really hard to get the blood sugar balanced and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Right. So your brain cells also need the glucose. Yeah. So that's a very good insight right there. Our brain cells produce energy by uptaking glucose, right? So if you
are not in a state of ketosis, they're not optimized to burn ketones. So for the most part, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. And I think one more question, I think, before we wrap up. Soraya wants to know, you mentioned the B vitamins,
mm-hmm.
and she wants to know which specific B vitamins. She said she's had good results adding, supplementing B12 and improving her thyroid function. Could you say more about the B vitamin supplementation?
Yes, I would say the B12 is probably the most important when it comes to boosting thyroid function. So that's a validation why you know, the fact that you actually feel better with supplementing on B12, that's definitely a commonly used B vitamin for thyroid function. But this can be very complicated again. So some people just can't handle, right? Because of the genetic issues, and I'm not going to go there today. there are different types of B12. Can you tell me what form of B12 you take?
I'm not sure if Soraya is still on live, but okay. I haven't seen it in the chat. But
sounds like she had a good response to it, so she's probably taking one that's
the right
genetically compatible, because if she wasn't, she'd probably feel really badly. In taking it,
excellent. All right.
The other vitamins from a B perspective that I would say are super important are the first three, 1, 2, and 3, because of their connection with the Krebs cycle. And the Krebs cycle is where we make energy. And if we don't have enough of those nutrients to make energy and the thyroid sluggish, then we're going to be even more sluggish. So you could see a boost there as well.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. So that's why I just like to pick a B complex, which has pretty much all the Bs in it.
I'm just going to disagree there with, for one reason, right? That it, with B12, it's not always best to get or rely on a B complex. Mm-hmm. It's great to get the balance, but with B12, because it's so difficult to absorb, you have to have a chemical called intrinsic factor that gets produced by your stomach to carry it down to the lower part of the intestine to be absorbed. And a lot of people, they don't absorb it. Like they, it could be in the vitamin, but they're not able to make enough intrinsic factor to carry it down. And this is especially as people get older and their stomach acid goes down. So I'm a kind of a big fan of B12 in either a sublingual, either a capsule that, or a tablet that dissolves under your tongue, or a liquid, or liposomal, which bypasses and it'll actually get absorbed in the upper part of the small intestine easily because of the way the liposomes carry it in. Or a patch, B12 patch can be a really good way to get it so it's on the skin. So B12, and like if you have a methyl B12 in a combination formula, you may only get a very little bit of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that wraps up the questions that have been submitted by our audience. And I wanted to thank everyone so much for being here and for your curiosity and for interacting. And thank you, Jenny, for giving us this really, really important, potentially life-saving information for a lot of folks. It sounds like it's a really common issue, particularly for women. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to invite everyone to kind of close and say goodbye. So on the count of three, I'm going to unmute everybody. You can say goodbye, and that'll wrap up our presentation for today. 1, 2, 3. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, guys. Thank you, guys.
That was awesome.
Bye.
Bye.